This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 35 was recorded on October 13th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Morgan Creek Capital founder Mark Yusko will be joining me as today's feature interview guest. Mark and I will be discussing this week's upside breakout in the U.S. dollar index above recent cycle highs, the European banking system and Deutsche Bank in particular, the Chinese online retail market, the oil and gas industry outlook, and much more. I think you're really going to enjoy Mark's views, as many of them sharply contrast those expressed by other guests that we've had on the program in recent weeks.
And I'm Aaron Chan. Before we even move on to equity markets, I'd like to start with your comments on a bizarre event last Friday. Now, just hours after we taped last week's show, the British pound sterling crashed by 6% against the US dollar in less than 2 minutes. Now, this occurred in the Asian trading session early Friday morning. Eric, what is the significance of this event?
I think it has huge significance, and I'm disappointed. You know, we've gotten to the point of complacency where you can have $10 trillion of negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. That makes zero sense, and everybody thinks it's normal now. You have financial markets that go up in reaction to bad economic news because they assume that that means more accommodation is coming. So we've turned the price signal upside down, and now we've gotten to the point where there's a major flash crash. Everybody's like, oh, flash crashes. Everybody's used to those by now. We've been having them for years.
No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. And, you know, the reality of the situation is that high-frequency trading has driven the human liquidity providers out of the system. And as a result, regulators are basically ill-equipped. It's impossible for regulators. They don't have the tools to analyze what high-frequency trading algorithms are doing in, you know, nanosecond time intervals. What happens, though, is because the human liquidity providers are no longer there, when the high-frequency trading algorithms panic and think something is wrong, they pull all their bids and suddenly the liquidity evaporates from the market. And that's what happened here. Now, we're not talking about Thai baht priced in, I don't know, Swiss francs. Dollar pound is probably the second or third most liquid market on earth. And currencies in general are famously very liquid. They're one of the few things, the reason they're preferred by the really big macro hedge funds is that they can absorb billions of dollars of capital in a single trade without moving the needle too much. This was a case, it did admittedly happen during thinly traded Asian trading hours, but, you know, maybe it started with a fat finger, who knows, but 6% in 2 minutes, that's not supposed to be possible. And, you know, it got lots of attention for like a day or so, and it seems to have been forgotten. And it blows my mind. We've gotten to a point where markets are just not sound anymore. And at some point, I think this whole high-frequency trading thing, you know, all the machines are going to shut off one day. There's going to be no liquidity, and we're going to have a major systemic event result from it. And it's not like we haven't seen plenty of evidence of the problem. And, you know, I don't think it's so much that regulators are failing to respond. They don't have the ability and expertise to respond. They don't know what to do. So I think it's a big deal.
The S&P 500 has shown some weakness in the wake of the presidential debate, and a key technical support level was violated this morning, albeit only briefly and on an intraday basis, when S&P futures plunged briefly to 2107 before rebounding. Now, E-mini S&P futures close on Thursday at 2126. So, Eric, what's your outlook for the stock market here?
Well, as far as violating that key technical level, it happened on an intraday basis. We did close, as you said, at 2126. So I don't think we've seen it yet. I wouldn't be surprised if it's coming, though. What really shocked me, though, is how little volatility we had during and since the presidential debate. The first debate, we had a huge amount of volatility. Futures markets were trading. E-mini S&P futures were up and down almost every time somebody seemed to score a point in the debate. And we only saw 2 or 3 points of up and down during the whole debate, which really caught me by surprise. The other thing that's, I think, very interesting is there was, as far as I'm concerned, a very clear correlation pattern where if Hillary was starting to win or, you know, score a point in some way, markets were up. If Donald was winning points, markets were down. That correlation seems to have gone. I think just about everybody would agree, even Donald's most staunch supporters would have to agree that Hillary has certainly won the rhetoric contest for the last few days with this tape coming out about Donald from 11 years ago on Friday. And you would think maybe there would be some upside as a result of that. The opposite has been true. And we've also seen quite a bit just from the transaction volume on S&P puts that it looks like the smart money, the institutional money, is buying a lot of hedging, downside risk. So despite Hillary doing better, it seems the Hillary is a shoe-in equals market races higher. That's been forgotten. So I think that's very interesting. It's really a question, though, of what happens from here. Mark Yusko is going to have some very interesting views about where this equity market is headed. So let's just save it for his interview coming up in just a few minutes.
Let's stay on the election for a minute. We announced last week that our policy will be to ask our guests and ourselves to refrain from espousing our personal political views, but to instead comment objectively on what various political outcomes could mean for markets. So, Eric, any update to your view since last week?
Well, certainly, as I said, the Hillary win equals big upside for markets. It seems like that sentiment has faded. I feel that there's kind of a Brexit deja vu here. And what I mean by that is, although the polls very clearly show in the last few days that Hillary has shot ahead, Trump is not looking good at all as a result of last Friday's sexual comments and so forth that he made in a recording from 11 years ago. Everybody seems to be saying, okay, you know, it's next to impossible for Trump to win yet. I think it's very foolish to assume that. Look at how much has changed in a week. We have a few weeks to go. We don't know how much more WikiLeaks has in terms of dirt on Hillary that they're going to release. We don't know how this could be turned around. And I'll give you a hypothetical example. And again, I stress it's hypothetical. It's not a prediction. But there have been rumors circulating for the last couple of days that it may have actually been Ryan's staff who leaked this tape about Donald Trump for the purpose of sabotaging his campaign. Now, if that were proven true, and I don't believe that it has been proven true yet, but if that were proven true and Trump came back swinging and said to his supporters, look at what's going on. They made a spectacle in the beginning of the primary debates. They have everybody raise their hand except for me saying, I swear I will support the Republican nominee. They all raise their hand. Now they're turning against me because the establishment is so wrong. It's about us, the American people, fighting the establishment and then reaching out to Bernie supporters and saying, look at how Bernie got screwed. Hillary stole the nomination in the primary from Bernie. We've got to do something. And, you know, he pulls off a landslide. I'm certainly not predicting that. I think it's very unlikely at this stage. But my point is simply, this game ain't over until it's over. Anything is still possible. What I do see, if you want to know the real outlier, again, not a prediction. I think it's unlikely to happen. But the outlier that would be the catalyst that could set global financial markets into utter chaos would be if we go into election night, just as we did for Brexit, where the polls are pretty darn clear, within the margin of error that's been calculated, it's just pretty much a shoo-in that Hillary is going to win, and then Donald manages to pull off some kind of unexpected landslide victory because a whole bunch of swing voters changed their mind or were affected by the last weekend's rhetoric from Donald or whatever. If there were a unexpected Donald upset, I think it's almost a certainty that there would be calls from Hillary's side of this to declare the election, blaming the Russians as being fixed in Donald's favor. There was Russian hackers. Clearly, the polls showed that this wasn't supposed to happen. We have to declare the election results invalid and President Obama has to stay in office until a new election can be organized. Even if they only stay stuck for, you know, remember how crazy things got in the 2000 election when it wasn't really clear between Gore and Bush with the vote count in Florida and so forth. If there's even a week worth of President Obama saying we're going to not necessarily accept these election results until we do some more investigation as to whether Russian hackers were behind it, I think you could have a massive eruption of political unrest, violence, and utter chaos in markets. Again, that is absolutely not a prediction, folks. Don't put those words in my mouth. What I'm saying is we have ingredients where anything is possible. It ain't over until it's over, and I think it would be foolish just because Trump looks awful right now in the wake of this latest sex scandal. It doesn't mean Hillary's not going to look just as awful in the next Hillary scandal. This stuff has been changing every week. Who knows what next week is going to bring?
Yeah, Eric, I completely agree with you. And that last scenario described is definitely, at least what I've been saying, is a non-zero probability. So definitely interesting to keep watching. Now, before we move on to crude oil, I'd actually like to change our usual sequence of topics this week. Now, you're always saying that the U.S. dollar index is so important because commodities like oil and gold are priced in dollars. So this week's upside breakout on the DXY, I guess it begs some discussion before we move on to oil and gold. So, Eric, is this the big movement or moment that you've been looking for? You and Raoul Paul and so many of our guests have predicted where the U.S. dollar resumes its two-plus-year rally in earnest?
Well, the short answer is it's too early to tell yet. The previous cycle high was around 97.50. I think the actual number was 97.48 or 97.49. We had a daily close above that yesterday, and then overnight we traded all the way up to 98.12. What that says to me is, okay, we've had the breakout above the previous cycle high. It hasn't really stayed above that level for long enough to constitute a confirmation. A very common pattern in technical analysis is you'll have a breakout, and then it'll sort of fall back over and go back down to that key level. The test is now, did what was previously a resistance level turn into a support level? And we have seen this afternoon the trade back down to 97.51, just 1/100th of a point away from where that technical level was, and it's starting to rebound off of that. Can it hold it? If we go back up above 98.12 and stay there for a few days, I would say, okay, that's when you declare the breakout has happened and the bull case for the dollar is on. We haven't seen enough yet. This could be a false breakout, and certainly a daily close below 97.50 would be cause for concern that that may have been what happened here. It does look like the beginning of it, and I would add that because gold has also been weak, it tends to confirm the idea that we may be on the cusp of this dollar index rally taking off from here, as so many people have predicted. Fortunately, we've got a fantastic guest coming up. Mark Yusko is going to have an opposing view, so stay tuned for that.
Okay, finally onto crude oil. Rumors about an OPEC production freeze deal seem to come and go every day. So what's the outlook for crude oil here?
Well, as I've said before, I think the OPEC deal remains irrelevant from a real-world supply-demand standpoint, but a lot of people are buying it anyway. And hey, this spring we saw $10 of upside as a result of the Doha freeze talk, even though it really didn't mean anything as far as I was concerned. So anything's possible here. Let's go back to the hard numbers, though. Inventory, 4.9 million barrel crude oil build this week. Finally, a build. So it's tempting for me to declare victory or save face, as the case may be, and say, okay, finally, the big string of inventory builds that Art Berman and I predicted is coming true or starting to come true. Honestly, folks, we have to throw the view that Art Berman and I discussed on the Labor Day weekend show out the window at this point. Even if this is the beginning of a series of really big inventory builds, it's going to be too little too late. The thesis that we discussed then is if you had a series of builds through September and October, then by the time you got to fall refinery maintenance season, when the refineries are unable to process as much crude oil, that could have led to a storage crisis and a real big price drop. That ain't going to happen, folks, because even if we had 5 weeks in a row of, 5 million barrel weekly builds like we had this week, that would just offset the huge draws that we had for the last 5 weeks. We'd be back to where we started. So we're not going to have that storage crisis. What remains to be seen is, do we see more builds on inventory? This one, a 5 million barrel build in a single week seems like a big deal, but when you look at the rest of the numbers, Cushing 1.3 million barrel drawdown. Cushing is most important for the price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil. It's going in the other direction. Gasoline, 2 million barrel drawdown. Distillates, 3.7 million barrel drawdown. Now, without a doubt, I'm sure that hurricane influences had to do with those big draws on finished products. But at the end of the day, you've got 5.6 million barrels of finished products drawn down, 4.9 million barrels of crude oil build. It's almost a wash in terms of total inventory effect or net inventory effect. So I don't think that there was really huge news, and certainly the market action, on that 4.9 million barrel headline, the market just fell off a cliff, down a dollar in the first few minutes, but then it retraced fully, actually more than fully, within the next hour. And we're trading now higher than when that data came out. Art Berman has a new report out speculating that stocks have actually been overstated due to some fuzzy accounting practices at the EIA. There is a link in your research roundup email for registered users at macrovoices.com where you can find that article. And, it occurs to me, during that period where we had all of those unexpected builds in inventory, everybody was ridiculing API, the American Petroleum Institute, which reports its data a day before the government report, because it seems like API was getting it all wrong. Well, if Art was right and they've been overstating the government data, it's interesting that during those same weeks, API was actually expecting drawdowns, and then we got builds in the government data. Maybe even though everyone ridiculed API for being wrong, maybe they had it right all along. I did speak to Art. He says that he thinks that the recent series of drawdowns may just be adjustments and it may not reflect a real change in actual inventories. So it's definitely a moving target in terms of inventory numbers. Bottom line on this, I think as far as where we are, probably I think we're pretty much out of room here. We're back up to that high level we saw in June. If there is more talk, and particularly if OPEC and Russia talk about cutting, not just freezing, but cutting production, which is not what's on the table right now, that could certainly propel prices much higher. But I don't see a big move up from here unless we get that kind of consideration out of Russia and OPEC.
Got it. Now, gold has been treading water since we spoke last week, trading at about 12:59 on Thursday afternoon. So what's the update on the yellow metal, Eric?
Well, it's, as you say, treading water, and the way I'm looking at this is we're seeing what may be the beginnings of a significant upside breakout in the dollar index. We don't know that yet. So I think it's a hurry up and wait moment here. If that dollar index rally continues, and especially if we were to see a closing print above 98.12, which is the intraday high so far, that would say to me the dollar up story is on, and I would expect further weakness in gold as a result. I think also that there's a pretty good argument to be made that the Fed needs to get one more rate hike in before the end of the calendar year, not because it makes economic sense to do so, because it is a credibility and face-saving move. They've signaled so many times that there would be at least one more rate hike this year. So I think a token rate hike before Christmas is a distinct possibility, and I think that would result in a down spike in the price of gold, and that would probably be an excellent buying opportunity. So I don't want to line up too many dominoes here. We have to wait and see what happens with the dollar index breakout or perhaps false breakout. If it turns out to be a false breakout and the dollar index rolls over, maybe it's time to buy gold while you've still got the chance before the price goes back up above 1300. But if we see the dollar index rally continue, I think there's going to be more weakness in gold, and the buying opportunity will probably come at the end of the year, especially if we see that rate hike.
Got it. Now, for the last few weeks, we've been reflecting on your decision not to buy the dip, as you'd originally planned, by buying 10-year Treasury futures when the yield briefly topped 1.70% about a month ago. Well, guess what? Last week, you had a second chance at 1.70 again, but you were quick to pass, and you sure got that one right, with 10-year prices dipping this week to the point that the yield topped 1.82%. earlier this week. So you and Raul definitely got the call right. 1.70 was not the top in yields as many people expected. So what's next from here?
You know, I don't know, and I don't think anybody does. We did see at least 182. I saw that number go across my screen. Probably there was higher than that on an intraday basis, and I didn't even see it. We're back down to 174 right now. So was the 182 the top, or is it still going to go to 2%? I don't know. But in general, while Raul's scenario of a move up to 2% and then back down below 1%, it seems entirely realistic, but it depends on a recession in order to make sense. And I don't know for sure that we're going to see that recession, although I certainly think that there's a strong likelihood that we're headed into a recession in the next 6 months. I haven't seen it yet. So I also think that Jeff Gundlach's argument is very good. If we get to sub 1% yields on the 10-year, which is Raul's scenario, that's where I think the real opportunity lies. It's time to go short there because, yeah, it can go from 1% to 50 basis points. But, you know, how much farther does it go and how long are you going to make money on the other side of this when the trend eventually does top out and reverse and being short treasuries is the place to be? So I don't think I'm going to try to chase the long side of this trade, but I also do not think it's time to go short here. I think it's time to see if that recession plays out and we do get sub 1% 10-year yields to look for the strategic entry opportunity for a long-term strategic short position. Right now, I'm just sitting on the sidelines.
Great. Thanks for the market update, Eric. Mark Yusko ran the Notre Dame and then University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's endowment funds before going on to found Morgan Creek Capital. Eric's interview with Mr. Yusko is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me as today's featured guest is Mark Yusko from Morgan Creek Capital. And Mark, I've really been looking forward to this interview because, frankly, as you know, the worst thing that can happen is to sit around with people who agree with you completely and all think that you're smart and then have the market prove you wrong. And we've had a lot of guests on the program recently that have agreed with a lot of my views, and I much prefer someone with some contrasting views. So along those lines, let's start with the U.S. dollar. So many of our guests have taken the view I've had that the U.S. dollar rally is probably set to resume. And of course, this week, it looks like we may be seeing the beginning of that with a breakout above 97.50 on a closing basis, trading as high as 98.12 briefly in the overnight session. I think you have a different view on the dollar. So I'm actually buying dollar futures this week. I'm guessing you would tell me I should be selling them. How do you see this U.S. dollar situation?
No, I would indeed. And, you know, one of the things I like to live by is that if two people always have the same opinion, one is unnecessary. So my big thing is to always try to be necessary. But I actually do have a very differentiated view on the dollar. You know, we think the dollar has peaked for this cycle. We think historically the dollar peaks when the Fed raises rates. The Fed raised last December, so we think the dollar peaked right around the November-December time period last year. It's actually been dead money here really for 18 months. If you're a technician, it's created a gigantic bear flag and looks like it's getting ready to break down pretty hard. But my view is really more of a fundamental view. I think that the dollar is due for a long, slow deterioration away from its dominant position as the only world reserve currency. And I think that really came to light here with the ascendancy of the renminbi into the SDR, which is now a reserve currency. You know, the dollar is still the world reserve currency. But the renminbi has a long-term plan, and I think it's got its sights set on the dollar long-term as well. So longer discussion. But I think, you know, there's a lot of also, I think, misplaced belief that the Fed's going to raise and maybe even raise dramatically, which is going to be good for the dollar. I think nothing could be further from the truth. I think the Fed won't raise this year or even next year. I think they are going to be faced with a recession in the U.S. and pretty tough to raise interest rates into that recession. So, and then on top of that, my biggest reason for a lower dollar is just the decline of petrodollars. More and more transactions are occurring not in dollars. Chinese and the Russians are now doing oil and gas trades directly in renminbi. There's other countries around the world that are skipping the translation into dollars. And that hegemony that was the dollar being the only trade currency for oil and gas, I think, is gone. And then you can throw on top of it just the fact that global trade is declining. We've got this rise of populism and isolationism and protectionism all the way back to Smoot-Hawley, 1930s. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure, and a lot of global trade is denominated in dollars, and there's going to be less demand.
And I think that plays very nicely into our next topic, which is the equity market. And you wrote a piece, I think it was earlier this spring, called 2000 All Over Again. And it definitely resonates for me. But the problem I have with this market is so many smart people, whether it's George Soros or Stan Druckenmiller, or recently we had Ray Dalio out saying the credit cycle is over. So many people are saying really bad things could be coming for this equity market. But I've felt like it was overpriced for a few years now, and I kept being proven wrong.
Yep.
So what do you think it is about right now that maybe is the turning point where finally these crazy equity valuations come back down to earth?
Well, I don't think you're wrong at all. I mean, we have been overvalued for a number of years, right? That's fact. Now, we haven't had the correction that people have been predicting, and I've probably been in that camp. I was probably a year early. I thought last year we would see a recession, and then about mid-year last year, I kind of bumped it out a year and said, okay, the Fed really is committed to, well, not just the Fed, all central banks really are committed to this liquidity parade. So pushed it out here to 2016-17, which actually lines up better. And you know, I tweet a lot at Mark Yusko, and my thing is hashtag 2000.2.0. And the reason I think it's going to play out very similar to 2000, 2001, 2002 is 2000, we had the highest equity valuations in history. Today, we're at the second highest in history. Actually, if you break out the median PE, it actually is even higher than 2000. In 2000, we had a very narrow part of the market in technology and TMT that was really, really crazy. And everything else wasn't bad. In fact, there were places that were downright cheap. Small cap stocks were cheap. REITs were cheap. Today, there's nothing cheap. I mean, we call this the everything bubble. Bonds are expensive. Stocks are expensive. Stocks across all industries are expensive. I mean, there are some stupid stuff like consumer discretionary and the low volatility names. I love to pick on ExxonMobil. You know, for 40 years, ExxonMobil's PE has been 12. And because of these crazy low vol ETFs that just buy without thinking, I love the fact they call them smart beta, which is a total oxymoron. I mean, it's like jumbo shrimp. Beta can't be smart. It's rule-based. It's dumb by definition. So they've bid up ExxonMobil to 35 times PE. So you're absolutely correct. There's no question that that is overvalued. You know, there's no way they can grow into that valuation. And so it's got to correct. The question is when. And so every smart person I know that manages their own money, whether it's George Soros or Julian Robertson or Jeremy Grantham, who I had coffee with yesterday in Boston, every single one of them is flushed with cash. Seth Klarman, I just wrote a long letter called The Value of Value about Seth Klarman, and he's up over 50%. Warren Buffett's up over in the mid-50% in cash. Everybody has a lot of cash that really cares about their capital. And the only people I hear talking about, you know, stock market going to new highs are people who are managing other people's money. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. In fact, a year ago, July, I put out a thought experiment out on Twitter, and I said, if you went to cash today and you avoided, you're going to miss the last 10% of the bubble top, and then you're going to avoid the down 38 to 40% normal correction, because that's a normal correction, how would you, you know, why would you be less off? You'd have a dollar instead of 68 cents. And everybody blistered me saying, oh my gosh, the market's going to go up so much from here. Well, It peaked at up 6 from last July. Now it's back to only up 2. And after today, it might be back to flat. So I just don't think there's a lot of downside in holding a lot of cash here. And very similar to 2000, 2001, 2002, 2000, the market was only down 9%. 2001, the recession started down another 12%. It was 2002 where the big downdraft happened, down 22%. And I think the same thing will play out here. The recession next year in 17, you know, double-digit down year. But the real down year is when after all the debt blow-ups occur in the energy space from that massive debt bubble that was created a couple of years ago.
I think that's an excellent prediction and an excellent thesis, but let me just play devil's advocate here. Let's suppose what you describe starts, and I think that your logic is extremely well-placed, and things start to look like 2000 all over again. What it seems to me is different now is central banks have not the slightest bit of hesitation about just throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, at propping up asset markets. So the question I ask myself is, what's to stop them from conjuring a few more trillion out of thin air and using it to prop up asset markets? And, you know, the one thing
such
that occurs to
question.
Me, at some point, we're going to hit runaway inflation, and that shuts the game down. But until we get to that point, what stops the central banks from just printing a few trillion more and solving the problem?
Well, you know, it's such a great question and really important. And I think what's interesting about it is we have to look at what's actually happening versus what these central bankers say. They are really, really good at jawboning. You know, Mario Draghi, you know, whatever it takes, except he hardly ever does anything. In fact, you know, the problem that he faces is he's now out of bonds to buy. And he can't do anything else. He can't buy equities. He can't buy ETFs like Japan. Same thing with the U.S. The U.S. hasn't expanded their balance sheet for 18 months. Surprise, surprise, the stock market's flat for 18 months. There must be a correlation there. Well, the reason that the ECB and the Fed are on the sidelines is they literally just ran out of stuff to buy. And by law, they are not allowed to buy ETFs and REITs like they are in Japan. So the Bank of Japan has been trying to keep the party going. But let's look at the facts. Bank of Japan has been expanding they're not expanding their bond buying. They ran out of bonds to buy because they're up to like 38% of all the JGBs. But they did run out. They didn't run out of ETFs to buy. They're up to 50% of the ETF market. And they said, oh, I'll take it up to 2/3. But what's happened to the Japanese stock market in last year? It's down 20%. What happened to the European stock market since the ECB started buying corporate bonds? It's down 20%. So I think the faith in central banks' ability to conjure value is dissipating. And I think, you know, for the first time I think ever, someone said this morning, the Fed used the word credibility in the minutes, and they used it 4 times. And like, you can't lose credibility if you never had credibility. So I think we are at that bang point that people have talked about for many years where, you know, central bank is out of tricks, and now gravity is going to come back and take over, and people are going to have to, you know, I grew up in the time of the Roadrunner cartoon, and you know, Wile E. Coyote ran off the edge of the cliff, and he stood there suspended in midair until he looked down, and then he fell. So I think the markets are about to look down and see there's a lot of air underneath them.
Okay, well, it certainly could be a crazy ride. Let's move over to the European banking system. Our mutual friend Raul Paul and I talked about this, and Raul has been, as you know, very outspoken in saying that Deutsche Bank has been a canary in a coal mine for a long time, and he stopped short of saying that this is the Lehman moment for Europe, but he said it could be, and I think you have a very different view that perhaps Deutsche Bank is actually a value play as a buy here. So yep. Tell us why you see it so differently.
Well, Raul's a good friend, and again, we have some very spirited debates, and we agree on most everything, but on occasion, you know, whether it's on the dollar or whether it's on Deutsche. And actually, I'm not sure that we disagree that much on Deutsche. I think, you know, he has a couple other banks that he think really are in bad shape and probably go away over in Europe. The problem for Deutsche is it is Germany, right? There's comparing it to Lehman, I think is so comical, I can't stand it. I mean, Lehman was an also-ran investment bank in the United States, did not matter to anybody except Dick Fuld and maybe some shareholders that got taken out, but it was not systematic or central to the U.S. economy, and it wasn't worthy of being saved. Deutsche Bank, on the other hand, there's no question it is too big to fail. There's no question that it will be supported. But even more importantly, and I've been talking about this for a while, and it appears that maybe I had the little birdie that talked to me about it was right, in that it wasn't even going to have to be the German government that stepped up, because Deutsche is an incredibly valuable asset. When people compare the leverage ratios of Lehman and Bear to Deutsche, it just means they don't understand bank accounting, and they don't understand the difference between European banks that keep all the housing lending on their balance sheet as opposed to pawning it off to phony and fraudy Fannie and Freddie like they do in the U.S. So you can't compare leverage ratios in Europe to leverage ratios in the U.S. because they don't have the GSEs. So, you know, the thing about Deutsche is it's such a valuable franchise and such a valuable asset that you just saw, you know, the Qatari royal family saying, you know, they'll think about increasing their amount. My conspiracy theory on this was actually that the Chinese were artificially pushing down the price of Deutsche, kind of spreading the rumors so they could come in and buy the whole thing really cheap and really just own the European banking market. But it looks like there's going to be a battle between the Middle East wealth and the Chinese wealth, and we'll see who wins. But I think that's why Merkel was able to back away and say, we're not going to bail them out and appease the voters, because she's on the edge with her constituency, and they don't want to hear about bailing out the rich bankers. But I think it's going to be not a government bailout, but real money coming in and liquefying the assets, kind of the same way the Japanese did with the U.S. banks, like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs.
It's still kind of a grim picture for Germans, though. I mean, if you think about, you know, rephrasing what you just said, don't worry, we the German government don't have to bail out Deutsche Bank, because our entire banking system is about to be acquired by either Saudis or Chinese. We're just not sure which one yet. If I was a German citizen, I might be uncomfortable with the idea that my country's banking system was being bought out by foreigners. Do you think that this creates...
Absolutely.
I mean, does that create another risk in terms of Europe and Merkel's reelectability and so forth?
I think it would be hard, although not impossible, because it seems to me voting constituents are possible and capable of anything these days. But it seems pretty tough to make the leap that Ms. Merkel is responsible for the bad, you know, banking system in the EU, and particularly Deutsche Bank, since she's not a board member and doesn't run the bank. But clearly, you know, everyone wants to blame the president and the chancellor for everything these days. So it's really quite astonishing how, you know, populism has really grown. So I agree with you that you could see that type of backlash. But at the end of the day, economics, I believe, wins. And, you know, when it comes down to, you know, what's in the best interest of the citizenry, is it better to have the bank fail and have them have to have higher taxes to bail it out, or worse, do a bail-in where they actually just start stealing people's deposits? I think given the choices of a foreign owner, or, you know, spending your own money to bail out, you know, the people that made the bad loans, I think they'll choose the former than the latter, would be my guess.
Okay. Let's keep the trip around the world rolling here over to Asia. You've recently been in the press with, actually, you and Jim Chanos having opposite views on Alibaba. But I'd like to take a step back from that specific discussion before we get into Alibaba in specific. And just help me get my head around this Chinese middle class and online retail in China. Because on the one hand, it seems like obviously China is huge. The size of that country is between 1.3 and 1.6 billion people. They're not sure. So what they call a rounding error is the entire population of the United States. But at the same time, yep, you know, they're not as rich as the United States. They have a much higher percentage of disposable income that just goes to food. So I'm trying to get my head around what is the scope of the Chinese middle class? How much of an online retail market is there, really?
We could talk all day about this. I mean, I think the most exciting opportunities on the planet are in Chinese consumer patterns shifting and becoming a consumer economy. E-commerce and healthcare are the two biggest beneficiaries of that. And I said we could talk all day about just myriad examples of tremendous opportunities. You know, just little things like JD.com, you know, which is essentially the Amazon of China. You know, it was a 66x return for us in one of our private investments with a firm here in New York. I mean, just the scale and scope is just massive. 750 million people in China have bought something in the past year using e-commerce. That's more than the combined population of the U.S. and Europe. So it is by far the largest consumer market on the planet, and will be for the next decade until it's surpassed by India, which will probably surpass it probably 10, 15 years from now. But the Chinese e-commerce market, according to McKinsey, is going to grow 26% per year compounded for the next 10 years. The mobile component of e-commerce is going to grow 52%. So plug in 1.52 to the 10th power into your HP12C. That's a calculator for all the youngsters that never seen one. And you get 66, which means the market for e-commerce is going to be 66 times larger 10 years from now than it is today. So it's just an enormous, enormous opportunity. And, you know, I hate to think that I am that guy that just disagrees with everybody, but, you know, I'm not disagreeing with Jim. Jim believes that there's some shady accounting going on at Alibaba. And, you know, given how accounting rules work, I think most accounting is kind of shady, you know, the difference between GAAP and non-GAAP and all the things that go on. And, you know, we've heard all kinds of stories in the U.S. over the years, Enron and WorldCom and all kinds of shady accounting. So is there some shady accounting in China? There probably is. But one thing I am certain of with Alibaba is that it is the largest e-commerce company. It is dominant in so many markets. Heck, their mobile payments business is worth, you know, a huge amount higher than it's currently valued. This thing they've done, Ant Financial, has got huge potential. You know, they started a money market account a couple of years ago, and in 6 months raised over $8 billion in a money market account. I mean, it became the third largest money market account in the world in a matter of months. It's just the power and the scale and the scope of the network effect. And, you know, I was kind of disappointed on Monday. Paul Romer didn't win the Nobel Prize, although it was funny, NYU actually accidentally released a test page on their website saying that he did, because they wanted to be ready just in case that he did. And he probably will next year or the year after. But this guy, you know, he has this theory called the theory of increasing returns. And basically what it says is as a network grows larger, it becomes exponentially more valuable, and you actually get higher profits. Most people think when there's more competition, you get less profits, but the actually opposite happens. And then the last thing that favors China is they don't allow the large U.S. companies to compete in China. So they like their national champions. So you've got the BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. But now you're starting to see new businesses pop up. You know, we just invested in one that's going to create the largest food distribution company in China, because they're not going to let Sysco, S-Y-S-C-O, into China. So, you know, I think we'll make probably 10, 15 times our money over the next decade by, you know, helping to build this company that delivers food to restaurants. Because I'm not sure of a lot, but I am certain that they're going to eat out more in China over the next decade, two decades, three decades. And then the last thing I'll leave you with on this point is, if you look over the last 50 years in the United States, five sectors have dominated: consumer retail, consumer staples, technology, healthcare, and alternative and energy. Those same five sectors are going to dominate China over the next four decades. And it's going to be the greatest consumptive boom that the world has ever seen. When you combine India and China, or Chindia, as I like to call it, just the opportunities are so vast and so amazing. I just can't get enough of it.
You started to mention India. Let's zoom out even further than that to just look at emerging markets in general. A lot of people who have been bearish emerging markets are bearish because of their strong dollar bullish views. So I would imagine not having that view, do you have more of a bullish outlook for emerging markets in general across Asia and around the world?
Yeah, we've been bullish emerging markets all year and have been overweight, not overweight enough, given that it's, you know, those markets are up 16-17%. And some of them, like Brazil, are up close to 70%. Yeah, we missed that one a little bit. We did not think that they actually would impeach Dilma, and they did. So good for them, because that was a necessary step. And now we think the upside in Brazil probably continues for a while. But we love the emerging market story. You know, I'm a big believer in demographics, and demographics is destiny. And I also am a big believer in Willie Sutton syndrome. You know, they asked Willie Sutton years ago, why do you rob banks? And he said, well, it's where they keep the money. So, you know, where's the growth? You invest in equities for growth. Where's the growth? It's in emerging markets. And, you know, again, demographics is destiny in the sense that over the next 75 years, we know that one in three people in Europe will disappear. We know that the U.S. will stay flat. We know that Africa will grow by 2 billion people. Nigeria will go from 150 million people to 450 million people. So frontier markets are even more exciting than emerging markets. But, you know, we really like the stories in India and China. We like the story in Brazil and other parts of Latin America. You know, take a company like Mercado Libre, which is an online company formed in Argentina, just created the first post-Macri billionaire. In Argentina, Argentina is a story. I mean, in fact, if I were 26 and unmarried, neither of which I am, I might move to BA today. I think Argentina is going to be just an unbelievable story over the next couple decades, with great leadership, great assets, and only 13% equitization, meaning equity value to GDP, whereas, you know, the U.S. is 126, way overvalued. Average is about 70 around the world. So, you know, we go down through a list of other countries. You know, we even like Russia because assets are cheap. We think the retail story is quite astonishing there because it's the largest retail market in Europe and that the retail stocks there have been beat up. I think the big fear about emerging markets is currency and the dollar. Again, since we don't think the dollar is rising, we think that that's a tailwind for emerging markets, not a headwind. And the other thing that people forget is in anticipation of the dollar rally from 14 continuing, investors around the world crushed EM currencies back in 14, 15. I mean, absolutely crushed them down 30, 40, 50, 60%. And so now that the dollar has been dead, I mean, the dollar's been flat for 18 months, people are saying, whoa, wait a second, emerging market currencies already went down. Maybe they don't need to go down as much. So now they've been rallying, which is part of the reason, you know, that Brazil's up so much is the real has had a huge rally this year. So, you know, are there risks? Sure. You know, if the world goes into a massive currency devaluation war, you know, emerging market currencies will participate too. But I do think that the growth will bail them out. Whereas I think in the developed world, you have the killer D's. You have bad demographics, you have too much debt, and you have persistent deflation. In the emerging markets, you have great demographics, you don't have a lot of debt, and you have actually inflation. And it's the good kind of inflation, the low and stable. So, you know, we think it's a great story. We think there's lots of money to be made.
Moving on to oil and gas, you were one of the first people to call for $30 oil back when that prediction was considered utterly insane. I think you were left out of the room when you first said it way back whenever that was. And, of course, yeah, you were proven exactly right. So, you know, it's probably worth touching briefly on the short-term picture. We've got talk about an OPEC freeze supposedly next month. I'm curious about your comments on that. But more importantly, big picture, it sounds like you feel that the bottom is in and it's time to be buying energy. Is that right?
Kinda. I do think the bottom is in. I think 26, 21 in February was as low as we're going to see for this cycle. But I don't think we need to rush out and get super long because I don't think oil is going back to 100. I know there are a lot of people, you know, this morning, all the chatter about, oh, 60 is the new 50 and it'll be 70 by next year. And, and Pierre Anderon, who I have incredible respect for and think he's the axe in oil, I think is maybe even a little bit aggressive, but I hate to disagree with him. And our view is pretty simple in that if you look at the you know, what caused the decline, it was a supply shock. It was not a demand shock. And everyone's been trying to apply these demand shock models from the last 40 years and not recognizing that it was a supply shock like OPEC back in the 70s. And so the difference is that Saudi made a decision, and I think a bad decision, but they made a decision essentially to abdicate their role as swing producer in an attempt to try to kill off American shale. And what they didn't count on was the technological wizardry, which is really what it is. I mean, we have some private investments. You know, what used to take 2 months to drill a well, they're doing it in 11 days. I mean, it's just absolutely extraordinary what's happened. You know, by fracking, by using more sand in your fracks, you're doubling the output without, you know, any additional or with very little additional cost because sand is pretty cheap. So lots of additional supply is going to come on anytime oil gets much above $50. So we think we're going to be stuck in this kind of trading range between 40 and 60 for a while. I think the idea of an OPEC freeze, again, there's another oxymoron. You know, OPEC hasn't been able to agree to not cheat for as long as it's been in existence, for 60 years or something, 50 years. So I don't know how they're going to start now. In fact, it's so funny. It's like everybody said, no freeze, no freeze, no freeze. Let us get our own production up to as high as we possibly can. So Saudi got theirs up to records. Russia got theirs up to records. And then they said, okay, now we'll do a freeze. And Iran is basically saying, screw you guys. We're not going to freeze. You know, we finally got the ability to pump again. So I think it's a lot of sound, very little fury. I don't think anybody's really paying much attention to it long term. I think short term, you know, traders had a field day with it. And we got a little rally last week, but I just don't see it happening. I don't see Saudi even participating. I really don't. I think what Saudi Arabia figured out 2 years ago is their enemy is not the other OPEC members. Their enemy is not shale. Their enemy is solar. You know, we are only six doublings away from having enough solar power to power everything that we need on the planet. And what that means is Swanson's law says the power of solar doubles every 2 years. So we are six doublings away from having enough to power everything. We don't need oil. Now, that's probably not going to happen because there's a lot of entrenched, you know, uses for oil. But I do think that Saudi thought they had a 200-year asset. Now they think they have a 20-year asset, and they're trying to figure out ways to diversify their economy and not be so reliant on oil. So I think there's a whole different game that's being played, and oil is just one piece of it. But yeah, we do like longs in the best basins in the U.S., you know, the Permian Basin and the SCOOP/STACK in Oklahoma. We think the companies there are killing it, and they're making lots of money, and they're good things to own. But I wouldn't rush out and buy oil futures here.
Okay. I want to ask you a particular question. I couldn't agree possibly more with everything that you said, particularly around OPEC just not being able to agree with itself. But I can't help but think, you know, if OPEC and Russia jointly agreed to just a 5% production cut and actually did it, actually honored their agreement.
Yep.
That would totally stabilize the market. We'd be back to $90 oil, and OPEC and Russia would all have more revenue, not less, as a result of the cut. What would it take, or is it impossible culturally, for them to see that and to take those steps?
Well, I think you're 100% right. We'd have $90 oil for, you know, a few months, because it would take a few months for the shale to crank it back up and, you know, put all those ducks, those drilled but uncompleted wells back online and you know, drill some more long laterals and increase the production. So I do think it would be short-lived, but you're absolutely right. It could definitely happen. I mean, even, you know, the funny thing is it's like the Fed. They wouldn't even have to do anything. All they have to do is say they were going to do it. If they announced a million barrel a day cut, oil prices would spike and you'd have a short squeeze of epic proportions. So, you know, what would it take? See, here's the funny thing. I have yet to figure this one out personally, is I understand why Saudi, you know, realized that their 200-year asset was not worth as much as they thought. I got that part. So my what to me what they should have done, right, is they should have announced the million barrel a day cut back in Thanksgiving of 2014, kept oil prices at 100, quickly did an IPO of Aramco, banked that money, and started building solar panels. Instead, by not cutting, they let oil prices fall to as low as $26. And at $50 here, if you got 3% more market share, but you're selling at half the price, you have less revenue. It makes absolutely no sense to me, because they did have control back in 14. I think now the problem is they've lost that control. And maybe what they realized is they'd lost the control in 14 too, and that shale was on the verge of this major breakout and was going to produce, you know, 11 or 12 million barrels a day. Maybe that's what they figured out.
Speaking of trends that make absolutely no sense whatsoever, you know, back in the day when things were normal, I always learned that you bought equities for capital appreciation and bonds for yield. It seems like somehow the new school of thinking has turned that around, and people are actually looking at large cap blue chips as a yield instrument, buying equities for yield, and focusing on bonds for capital appreciation because they think that there's, you know, further to go in lower interest rates. What could go wrong in this scenario?
Everything. The two things you just described, you know, bonds as equities and equities as bonds, I think have to be, in my lifetime, in my career, have to be the most dangerous things I've ever heard. I mean, other than maybe portfolio insurance was worse back in 87 when I first got in the business, these are the most dangerous things. And this whole movement toward, you know, low volatility, high dividend ETFs, as I said, you know, they've pushed ExxonMobil to 35 times, absolutely ridiculous. They've pushed Hormel Foods and Campbell Soup to 20 times. These companies have negative unit growth. Their businesses are falling, and yet people are paying 20 times earnings like they're a growth stock because they pay a 3% dividend. It's absolutely insane. And people are going to lose 10 years of yield in a matter of months during the next correction. Now, whether that correction lasts 3 months, 3 years, or maybe we're in a period where, you know, Jeremy Grantham's predicting that the market's the real return on equities is going to be, you know, somewhere around 1 or 2%, you know, over the next, I'm sorry, negative 1 or 2%. Over the next, the real nominal around 0 to 1%, the real return is going to be, you know, -2% over the next 7 to 10 years. Well, if that happens over 7 to 10 years, that's kind of the slow water torture. If it happens over 7 to 10 months, like a, you know, 2007 2008, you know, that's kind of ugly. If it happens like 2000 to 2002, over 3 years, which is what I really think is going to happen, you know, that's ugly too. But you'll end up down 40%. You lose 10, 12, 14 years of yield, and that's not a bond. There's the thing that people forget, and I don't know why they forget it, is if you think about the nature of claims, bonds are contractual claims, right? If they don't pay you, you can sue them. Equities are a contingent claim. You only get money if everybody else is paid off. And in some cases, the only way these companies are paying dividends is by borrowing money to pay out. So they're paying out more than their earnings. That is not sustainable. So I think it's an absolute nightmare waiting to happen.
Since you described it as the craziest thing you could think of, let me just try another crazy one by you, which is this trade that Raoul Paul told me about recently, which he says a lot of people have on in size, and they think it's a smart way to reach for yield. And that is selling VIX in size, VIX futures, just because the contango is so steep that the carry you get from rolling that position supposedly enhances yield. And I said to Raoul, that's not picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. That's reaching under the steamroller to try to get the penny out. I mean, holy cow.
It's a great description. Absolute perfect description. you know, it's like, oh, I want one of those, you know, squished pennies that you get at the carnival. So I'll use the steamroller here, and then I'll put my hand right there. Yeah, really, really, really bad idea. And but look, you know, investment banks and broker dealers and, you know, firms around the world are they exist to sell product to investors, and they're going to sell whatever they can possibly sell to charge a fee. And if people are willing to buy it, they will make more. It's like the old Doritos commercial, go ahead and eat them, we'll make more. So they don't really take a fiduciary view and say, boy, this is a really bad thing we're going to sell you. They say, hey, buyer beware, if you want to buy it, we'll sell it to you. So I think that all of these trends tend toward, you know, the Minsky moment. I know some people don't like to use that term, but I, you know, Hyman Minsky was a great economist, and it is true, right? The absence of something creates its presence. The longer you go without a hurricane, you know, eventually you're going to have a big hurricane. The longer you go without volatility, you're going to have big volatility. And we've seen that in spades in the past, and it has in the past 3 years because of this trend. You've seen this more erratic pattern of kind of buy the dips and you know the corrections that we think are here get truncated, and then they turn around fast and we get these rips back up. But if you look over the last 18 months, those rips back up keep taking us to the same place, and we're making this big rounding top, and people are getting, you know, short volatility, and I think it's going to be a nightmare. And when you combine short volatility plus long these low vol ETFs, when the cliff actually happens, I think it's going to be steeper and more dramatic, because everybody's going to be trying to get, you know, the old proverbial camel through the eye of the needle, just fur and hooves. So not pretty.
Well, you were an endowment manager, so you understand the real money side of this. If I heard about that trade that a bunch of speculators were putting on because they thought their hot money hedge fund could, you know, make a better return, I'd say, okay, dumb people are dumb. But this is something that pension funds that manage people's retirement savings are due. So it,
I know.
What it says to me is there must be a tectonic shift going on where there's so much pressure to reach for yield because these guys running pension money know that they're underfunded and they don't know what to do. Are they panicking? Is that what's happening? I mean, I don't see how it's possible that professional pension fund managers could not understand just the outsized risk that they're taking with a trade like that. But it seems like it's becoming the culture.
No, look, I think you're exactly right. It's kind of strange to think that it is happening at that level, but I think it's the fallacy of the advisor, right? And we saw this back in the 90s around, you know, Orange County, you know, buying these big derivatives, these leveraged, you know, bond contracts, you know, from one of the big broker dealers. And I think that the fallacy that if a big investment bank or a big broker dealer is selling you this product, well, they must have had people that did the research on it and it must be safe. You know, they wouldn't be selling it to me if it wasn't safe. Well, no, they're selling it to you because you're willing to pay a price and you're willing to buy it. So that, I think, is the problem is you've got people relying on external advisors that are bringing them these products. And look, you know, part of the challenge in the pension world, and this is not true of all pensions, but part of the problem in the pension world is most of them don't pay commensurately with equivalent jobs in other parts of the market, right? They think they want to save money on their compensation. And what that means is you end up getting, you know, less qualified people just by its very nature, right? The market is efficient. And so I think, unfortunately, and again, there's some great pension managers out, don't get me wrong. I mean, the guy who runs CalSTRS is fantastic, and there are a handful of guys out there I think are great. But I think, unfortunately, you know, if you don't pay market rate, you get what you pay for. And I think those people are more prone to rely on external advisors and rely on, you know, these things. And I think, unfortunately, we know how the story ends, and it's usually not very good.
Finally, I want to move on to the presidential race. Holy cow, so much has happened in the last week. There's even rumors this week that supposedly maybe it was the Republican Party itself that leaked this tape that's got Donald Trump in so much trouble. So, as you know, we discussed off the air, we ask our guests not to push their personal opinion, but just in terms of objectively commenting on what potential outcomes we could see on the horizon here and what they would mean to markets. Do you think that there's any chance of Trump being pushed out of the race, as it seems like they're trying to do? And if he was, what would it mean? How do you see the various different outcomes of either a Trump or Clinton presidency in terms of their effect on markets?
Yeah, no, look, I think if a candidate were to drop out of the race, either side, I think that would be perceived pretty negatively by markets. I think you'd have short-term, volatility around that event. I just think that would be a bad event. I mean, perhaps maybe you could make an argument that if Trump were to drop, that people would think that was less potentially volatile. So maybe there'd be a positive reaction. But that one's tough to call. I think what is striking about these types of events is we have actually a decent amount of history. You know, we have six times where we've had 8-year presidents, and, five out of those six have had fairly negative returns for the full year. So the fact that we're still mildly positive is an anomaly. We also know that in most of the cases after that 8-year presidency, the first year of the subsequent presidency has a recession. So that's actually probably pretty likely, regardless of which side wins. The other thing that does historically happen is that when the incumbent party stays after an 8-year presidency, that's historically been better for the market. I think people just are assuming they there's more certainty, and markets hate uncertainty. So I think if Trump were to win, history tells us there'd be more volatility, not because it's Trump, but because it's the other party taking over for the incumbent party. I think having it be Trump, where I would say that most candidates change their mind and say whatever it takes to get into power. It's like Ms. May over in Britain. She was a Remain supporter until she realized that I can get elected PM if I say I'm a Leave supporter. So she totally changed her view in running for PM. It was unbelievable. So people will do or say whatever it takes to get in power. So, but the speed at which he changes his mind is the thing that's disconcerting to me. I mean, how do you plan as a long-term investor if, let alone you don't know what's going to happen month to month, but you know what's going to happen within one speech? So, and then the last thing I think that's important is for markets is when there's a divided president and Congress, that's usually better for markets. When you have both of one side or the other, that's usually less good because too many of the pet projects get pushed through and those usually cost money. So I would be worried about a Republican president, a Republican Congress doing some damage to markets. But that has nothing to do with the people that are running. That's just to do with I like my checks and balances in politics.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for a fantastic interview. I am sure a lot of our listeners are going to want to follow more of your work, and I would tell them where to, but there's so many places. You're very prolific on Twitter. I think you also have some other sources. So where can our interested listeners find out more about what you do?
Yep. So on a day-to-day basis, people can find me at Mark Yusko. We have a website that has some resources as well, which is Morgan Creek Cap. CAP.com. And then, well, from there, you can reach out to any of us here. And we have, we do have some white papers and other things we publish from time to time. I also do a quarterly letter that if you actually just Google MCCM quarterly letter, they'll all pop up in PDFs. You can read those. They're rather long. So, if you have a couple days to put aside, but I like to write about different people. I've written one on George Soros. I've written one on Sir John Templeton, one on Julian Robertson, one on Seth Klarman, and try to incorporate our views of the world into these great investors' disciplines and quotations. So lots of places to find out about Morgan Creek, but morgancreekcap.com is probably the easiest link to us and what people are looking for.
And I want to add my own endorsement on those letters. I just read your piece on Seth Klarman and really enjoyed it. So for people who do have time at the fireplace to take in a good read, although probably a slightly longer one than a lot of the other pieces we see, it's definitely worthwhile.
Well, thanks.
So thank you again, Mark. It's been a fantastic interview. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Wow, Eric, I don't know about you, but I think that's got to be one of the best interviews we've done. Now, I've been reading and engaging with Mark's tweets for a while now, and it's really cool when a guest is just as engaging, if not more, live as he is on social media. So for you FinTwit people, be sure to follow Mark at Mark Yusko on Twitter. And we didn't want to cut Mark's interview short, but unfortunately we're out of time, and I had a lot of questions. So Eric, is there anything you want to cover?
Well, we're going to have to save it. I think when we have a guest that's this good, I would much rather give the guest the stage and not worry about leaving time for us to talk about it afterwards. So if we have extra time in a future show, we'll maybe pick it up from there. Let's keep it short this week, folks. We need your help promoting the show. Please tell your friends about it. Please retweet us. And, of course, the most important thing, register your free account at macrovoices.com. That gets you our free research roundup email. If you don't want it, it's one click to opt out of it with the Safe Home subscribe link. Assuming that you do want it, you'll get a compendium of links to all the cool stuff we could find on the internet every week. Aaron, let's tell them what they can expect in this week's research roundup.
Well, I hope you've got some time this weekend because we're about to hit you with a deluge of excellent slide decks, including Lacey Hunt's presentation at James Grant's fall conference. Lacey's presentation lays bare the economically deleterious effects of over-indebtedness and straightforwardly outlines the characteristics of extremely indebted countries. He does mention that fiscal policy options exist, provided that they do not increase aggregate indebtedness. Now, if we ever get the chance to interview Mr. Hunt, it'd be great to get his take on what some of these policy options might be. Now, turning to emerging markets, you'll definitely want to check out the latest webcast slide deck from the fixed income team at Double Line Funds. Finally, check out JP Morgan's latest Guide to the Market slide deck. It's short on commentary, but the value is in looking at the charts and data yourself, and coming to your own conclusions anyways, and updating your thesis. You'll find all this and much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten, and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at _AaronChan_. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.